accession number 18266, Real 2.
This is Beasley, Real 2.
I think that my mother was quite sure, because of the tradition and the power of the British Navy, that she believed that it would come out on top. I certainly don't think she ever let on to us children that she was frightened or worried. But of course, one couldn't fail to see that friends and the sons of friends round about didn't come back. They were killed. And the husbands of younger people round about, that they were killed. So one was well aware of what was going on.
Now, can we pick up your own story? Oh, I was going to ask you if you had Churchill's broadcasts.
Yes. And it has left a colossal imprint on my mind. Now, how much of what I feel now is because I have reheard them and reheard them, and I've also read his books. How much of the original broadcasts have been, as it were, confirmed in my memory by subsequent things, I don't know. But I'm pretty sure that when one heard them, one was aware that what he was saying was of immense importance, and that in a funny sort of way, what he said, although he said it first, in fact, he was encapsulating what most people already believed. He had a sort of genius for being able to say what everybody felt but couldn't put into words, I think. So yes, I'm sure I remember the importance of his broadcasts, and that when one knew that Churchill was going to, when the Prime Minister was going to broadcast, we all listened to it. I think that was good dates right back to early on in the war.
How important to you was the wireless?
Oh, very important. One could always hear it. One could listen to the news. I suppose it was the 9 o'clock news, but I can't remember now. It's too long ago, but it probably was. One listened to the news and heard what was happening, and you read the papers and you saw what was happening. And because my father was busy fighting and was involved, and his name occasionally came up in the papers, he was known to the papers sometimes as Stormy Rawlings, because he was very much a fighting admiral. And the manager of the little local cinema in Bodmin would ring up and tell my mother that there was a clip on the newsreel of my father fighting, and then we'd all go in and watch it. So one was well aware of what was going on, the fighting scene.
Did you ever listen to Lord Hawthorne?
Oh, yes. Not often, not regularly, but just occasionally one did. It was quite fascinating to hear his rather prissy pronouncements and that sort of unreal accent that he had, and his extraordinary... I mean, one laughed at it. One didn't realise that there was any danger in it. But yes, one was aware of it.
Did anything he ever said shake people?
I don't remember it ever shaking anybody. I think the most response that it ever got was people laughed at it and thought, good heavens, does he really think we're going to believe that sort of rubbish? I think we were probably pretty cynical about it.
At this stage of the war, were you suffering any deprivations?
No, I don't think so. There was rationing and food was pretty basic. But the extraordinary thing was that one was... And, of course, it was very cold in the winter. There was heating. Heating was pretty non-existent at school. One was really very cold a lot of the time. But, no, I don't think so. It's a very odd thing, but... The rationing of food doesn't seem to necessarily affect the health of the nation. And on the whole, we kept surprisingly well and didn't suffer from anything more than coughs and colds, I don't think. I don't remember any of us being particularly ill. You did everything yourself. If you wanted butter, you got the milk from the farm and you made your own butter. If you wanted ham, you killed a pig and you salted the pork. Everybody became very much more self-sufficient. My mother, who had never cooked before the beginning of the war, taught herself to cook and became an absolutely first-class cook. We all had to set to and help in the house and help cook and wash up and do everything. And I think it was very good for us. I think we became a very working family in the sense that we all worked to keep the family going. So I think it was a very healthy thing, and we certainly remained very fit.
Now, can we come on to your leaving school? And, oh, perhaps we'd better say, was your schooling affected by the war?
I don't think it was affected, apart from the fact that there was rationing and it was cold. And unless their parents and family lived close by, you very seldom saw your family, because it was difficult to travel. There was no petrol, very little petrol, it was rationed. So that parents couldn't come up to visit you. My mother never came up to visit us because she couldn't get up. And so that nearly all the girls who were there, they didn't see their parents from beginning of term until the end of term. But it was just accepted as that's what happened during a war, and nobody complained, I don't think. It was, if you wanted to go anywhere, you had to go by bicycle or walk. And and clothes, of course, were rationed too. But then everybody learned how to sew. So if you wanted something, you usually settled down and made it, if you see what I mean, which nobody does these days.
Did you ever feel in danger in the Second World War as a woman or a girl going about in the dark, in the blackout?
Well, not when I was at school and not when I was at home, but I think that was because I was privileged to live in the country district. So that without turning a hair, I would walk the 2.5 miles from Bodmin out to the Llancarf where we lived in the dark by myself across the fields. And I wouldn't have even thought anything about it. I never expected to be molested or accosted. And if I had been accosted by anybody, I would have just thought it was a local person and would have said, "Hello, good evening. Oh, I'm just going home. What are you doing?" There was no feeling of danger. And when I was at school, as long as there were three of us, we were allowed to go anywhere. So, because there were three, we never got into difficulties. England, oddly enough, was a very much safer place in those days. You could walk anywhere. And as a girl, I never came to any difficulty.
What about in the city?
When I went to London, I don't really think I was ever very frightened. No, I don't think so. I think one was only frightened of bombs and things like that. I don't remember being frightened of people.
Now, leaving school and what you were to do on leaving school, please.
Well, the last 2 years, I stayed on after my school certificate, which was like the O levels in those days, and because I did higher school certificate. And so I had the last 2 years of studying at school were geared towards academic subjects. And I took the three subjects and I obtained pretty high results so that after the war I could go into university and went up to Bristol. So I had a satisfactory end to my schooling, as it were. And I left school in July '43, just before my 18th birthday, I suppose. And then I went to London to stay with a school friend. And immediately after my 18th birthday, and then I thought that I would like to apply to join up, and to join the Wrens, for the very simple reason that my father was in the Navy. And so I think it was my birthday was in the August, and I think that I went along to the office. I've forgotten what they used to call it now, the place where you went to be called up. Perhaps they just called it a call-up office, I don't remember. which I think was in Victoria Street, but I may be wrong. And I sat down and saw the woman behind the desk and said that I'd come because I wanted to volunteer to join the Wrens, and that I was only just old enough, I believe, to be allowed to join. And so she took down my details and all the rest of it, and then went off and saw somebody else. And then when she came back, she said, "Oh, I'm very sorry, I'm afraid you can't join the Wrens." So I said, "Well, why not?" I didn't know the Wrens were full at the time. And she said, "Oh, no, you can't join the Wrens because I'm afraid that you, with your particular date of birth or whatever it was, you have got to go into industry, probably into a munitions factory." And initially, I really didn't understand what on earth she was talking about, and said, "Well, if I can't go into the Wrens, perhaps I can join the WAFs or the Fannies or something else like that." And she said, "Oh, no, no, you don't understand. You cannot join anything except go into industry." So I said, "Well, perhaps if I could be a nurse, or perhaps if I can join the land army, because I've worked in the land a lot, perhaps that would be more useful." And she got quite irritable and said, "No, I didn't understand that I'd got to go into a munitions factory, and that there was no alternative." And I found this quite extraordinary. And so I said, "Well, look, I think I'll go home and I'll talk to my family about this, and I'll come back again a couple of days' time, and we'll have to resolve it." So that's what I did. I went home and I spoke to my parents and my mother. My father by this time was in Freetown. He was CNC South Atlantic. And I told my mother, and everybody was astonished, including the friends I was staying with. And my mother and the friends said, "Oh, well, if you're not allowed to join the Wrens, this is ridiculous. Let's see if your father can help so that you can join the Wrens and avoid this conscription into industry." But I had a feeling in those days, of which I'm not at all ashamed, that I shouldn't pull strings to try and get out of something that everybody else had to do, and that what was imperative for one person should be imperative for me, and that if other people were told they had to go into industry, then I must go in too. So, slightly against my family's and parents' wish, my mother's wish, I went back about 2 days later and said, "All right, then into a factory I must go." And I think the woman relented slightly and said, "Well, since you're under the age of conscription, if you find your own factory, you can go into that, and I won't send you to the Midlands or to Scotland or anywhere else where there is a requirement for you." So I knew that I could choose a factory, which is a funny thing to be able to do. And I had met, purely by chance, a remarkable lady called Mrs. Morph, who was the interior designer, interior decorator of Heels, which was a marvellous shop even in those days, very well known, wonderful stuff they had before the war. And she was in charge of all the design in Heels. And I'd met her on a social basis. And she heard about this extraordinary predicament I was in. And she said, "Oh, well, you better come and work with Heels. There's a parachute factory in Heels. I'll find out for you if they would take on an extra person." So that's what she did. And she got in. When she went in the next day, she saw the manager and said, "There's a girl here who I know who has been conscripted into industry. Can you take her?" And he said, "Yes, I can. I'll find work for her." And so that's why I went to Heels. I went back to the office and said I would like to work at Heels. It was in London. It was slightly nearer to my family and my friends than maybe the Midlands or North of England would have been. And it seemed a better choice than just waiting to be sent off to heaven knows where. So that's how I came to Heels. And that was in late autumn, mid-autumn, 1943, I think. Yes, it was.
What was the demeanour of the woman, or more than one person if it was, who interviewed you when you turned up at this office?
She was really rather bossy and quite irritated when I queried it. Looking back, I really wonder whether she made a mistake. For the very good reason that if a factory such as Heald's was short of workers, they didn't want anybody who had no skills. They wanted workers who were very good at being a seamstress, at machining, for example. I had no skills like that at all. All I had was some pretty good academic qualifications for a girl of my age. I was just 18. And I had no skills, apart from being able to do quite a lot of country things, at all. And so there was nothing that I had to sell to these places, which, looking back, really seems to me quite extraordinary.
Had you said to her at the time the reason why you wanted to go into the Wrens?
I didn't start with. I just said I would like to join the Wrens. And then when she said, oh, you can't join the Wrens, I said, but I particularly want to because my father is in the Navy. And I've got a strong link with the Navy, the Royal Navy, and I would be proud to serve with that service. Maybe, I don't know, but I told her then. And but she wouldn't listen. It seemed as though she was just following instructions. I think this is really, looking back, what she did. And when she went off to see the other woman, presumably she had her instructions confirmed, and when she came back, she said, no, you can't do anything except go into industry. So, and when I queried it, and she said, after all, you must have heard about the Bevin boys. If you were a man, I'd be sending you down the mines. But since you're a woman, a girl, you will go into a factory. And that is why, ever since, I have always thought that I was bracketed with the Bevin boys legislation, which sent down, I think, every 10th or every 20th young man into the mines, because the mines really and truly were desperately short of men. And that's why I felt there was a sort of similarity between my case and their case, and that is the other reason why I didn't protest anymore, because I thought there was a need for me to go and work in industry.
So you went to the parachute factory?
I went to the parachute factory.
Where was that?
That was in Tottenham Court Road. I got lodgings in Chelsea and shared a bedsit with a school friend. And we started work at 8 o'clock in the morning, which was very early. I got a bus up to Tottenham Court Road. The first day I went to the factory, you had to clock in. And I clocked in. If you arrive 1 minute past 8, you lost a quarter of an hour's pay. And 16 minutes past, you lost half an hour's pay. So one was really careful to be on time. And the first day when I was taken up to the big workshop, I think my first impression was of noise, of the many, many sewing machines working, and of the glare of the lights and of the white parachute silk, and of the enormous number of girls all busy working. It was a huge room because these rooms had been the first floor and second floor, particularly the first floor showrooms of this huge shop. And of course now they were filled with rows and rows of sewing machines. Huge machines, some of them, very big, powerful sewing machines. And I think it would be easiest if I said this was an Irving parachute factory under Irving's, and they supervised the whole thing, and they had inspectors who came round and made sure that the standard of work was as it should be.
Who were Irving's?
Irving's, the parachute makers. There were huge tables set out where they had where the parachutes were cut out. A parachute's made in a number of panels, great big triangles, which are stitched together. There are always an even number of panels, and each of these huge panels is subdivided into sections, so that the cutting out was of the sections, which were subsequently machined together in a two-needle run-and-fell seam until they were in the big panels, And then the big panels were then stitched together, but in a four needle run and fell seam with a channel up between the two outside rows of stitching. And they had to leave this channel up between the two panels because that's through this the parachute cords were threaded. They were threaded up between two panels and then across the gap in the middle and down through the two panels on the opposite side. That's why there were always an even number of panels. The parachutes that they made, we were making man droppers, white ones, for the RAF, which were all slightly less large than they needed to be, because when a man is bailing out from his aeroplane, he wants to get down to the ground and away from the fight and away from any possible machine gunning as quickly as possible. So the parachutes were slightly smaller than needed be. They were white nylon. Then we made khaki nylon ones for parachute regiment, and they were bigger because when the men dropped, they wanted to come down slowly to ensure that they had a safer landing, and also because they were carrying guns and heavy equipment. So the man droppers, which we made for the army, were slightly bigger than the man droppers we made for the RAF. We also made supply droppers, which were made of cotton, and they were different colours. And the different colours, the reds, the blues and the greens, they each colour dropped a particular type of supplies. The red ones may have dropped medical supplies, the blue ones food or something or the like that. And we also occasionally made very, very large khaki coloured ones, which they were used in series of four, and they dropped heavy things like guns and jeeps and things like that. So it was a very large factory. I think there were about 800 girls, something like that, but I may be wrong there, but there was an enormous number of women working. And these girls, as I mentioned briefly before, they were all expert seamstresses. They were simply marvellous. They worked terribly hard. They didn't shirk. There was a very good atmosphere in the factory, and everybody worked very hard. But they were very, very clever at machining. That was their skill, really. Nearly all of them come from working in clothes factories in London, in the East End of London. And that's what their job was before the war. And that's why they went into a parachute factory, because they were extremely good at their particular skills. So when I went... When I joined, I couldn't machine, so I was put on inspection of the materials. Once the materials had been cut out in these sections that I mentioned earlier, each section had to be inspected to make sure it hadn't got a flaw in it. And I was put on I sat on a stool in front of a large sloping desk thing, and up in front of me, these sections were placed, and I had to check them to make sure there were no flaws, and if there were, the flaws were marked and the piece was discarded. What was really, really very funny, really, the first day that I arrived, was that I was a freak to all the other girls and the women in the factory. All of them, well, if I put it the other way around, to them, I was a complete freak. I spoke what in those days was called Oxford English, and they all spoke splendid London Cockney, and so I was unusual to listen to start off with. I came from a totally different background, and I say that because I'd come from the country, and they'd come from the town, and the difference was enormous. I knew about country things, and they knew about the side streets of London. They'd come from noisy places in London, and I'd come from the quiet of the country. I'd come from a naval background, and they, on the whole, had not. I had stayed at school until I was 18 and was interested in things academic. Most of them had left school at 14, and some of them had gone on to grammar school and had left at 16. But we had very little in common, so when I first sat down and began my job and opened my mouth, there was a good deal of, come and see what we've got here, come and listen to her, which wasn't unkindly meant, but it was, it did identify the great gulf that there was initially between us. It didn't matter, because I liked people and I got on very happily with the girls I worked with. But it was an interesting start to my days in the factory. We worked awfully long hours. We started work at 8 and we had 3/4 of an hour for lunch, and we didn't finish until 6 at night, and we used to work on Saturday mornings. And if there was a push on, we'd work until Saturday evening. It was the inspection work I did for about 6 months. It was a responsible job in the sense that one had to check very carefully, but it was pretty monotonous. There's some little scope for interest if you're just looking at bright white fabric, looking for slight flaws. We used to have music while you work, and the only fun thing about that was that there was always a local sweepstake going on as to, and you could put a penny on which song you thought was going to come up first, and that was always quite amusing. There was a canteen where we used to go for a cup of tea, and people got their lunch there. But when the summer months came and it was so hot in the factory, I used to go out for my lunch and buy some bread and butter and walk through to a square just at the back. I think it was the one just short of Tavistock Square, and sit on a bench and eat my lunch there, where it was quiet, I think, and out under the trees. At that point, there was very little bombing going on. The raids had pretty well finished. But the bedsit where I lived down in Chelsea, there was an ACAC battery immediately outside our bedroom window, which was very noisy when it ever did go off. But after 6 months, I got terrible eye strain, and my eyes were very painful. I didn't realize what was the matter with it, but finally went to an eye person, and he said that I must have 2 months sick leave because I'd very nearly damaged my sight because the lighting was wrong. I don't know, looking back, what it was like, whether it was too bright or what it was, or whether it wasn't strong enough. But I know that he wrote to the manager of the factory and said that the lighting was bad. And I know that the union, which I was a fringe member in those days, objected on my behalf, which was entirely justified. I had terrible eye strain. But it didn't make me popular with the management. The manager didn't like me at all after that. But, however, after I came back from the 2 months sick leave, I couldn't do any more of the inspection work. And as I suggested earlier, there was little to do in the factory if you weren't a seamstress. So I was put on cutting lengths of webbing for the harness of the parachutes. That was, I think, the most boring job I've ever done in my life. It was absolutely soul-destroying, just cutting 2 foot, 3 foot, 3 foot six lengths of webbing over and over and over again from 8 in the morning till 6 at night with the guillotine. And it really was very hard to bear. However, I did that for some time, and it was during that time that the other girls in the factory, they were awfully nice and all very busy, and all they were really, they loved to talk amongst themselves about their boyfriends and their clothes and their films and things like that. And one day, everybody was working, and a soldier appeared in the